Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Last week, I was preparing to speak with you about Yeshua, and within the context of Parashat Vayigesh, and that is, of course, this wonderful passage where Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. But we had an ice storm. Now, here's the plan. If there is snow, no big deal. You make up your mind whether you can make it. We hope you can, especially if you're not having to take a lot of secondary roads, you know. The major roads tend to be pretty clear, except in the worst of snowstorms. But that's more or less up to you, and we will send you an email and change the message on the machine so you'll know what's going on. When it comes to ice, that's another matter. When it comes to the danger that ice poses, we just carte blanche. If there's an ice storm, you can be pretty sure there will not be services. We'll still send you emails, try and call you if you're in our directory, and put a message on the machine. But I was so excited about speaking to you from this magnificent Parsha. And of course, last week was the Shabbat prior to the celebration of the birth of Yeshua as experienced in the Western world. Now, I could say parenthetically that from a strictly historical standpoint, it's not likely that he was born on December 25th. And it has to do with certain evidences of various kinds that we don't have to get into. But it doesn't matter in one sense. Historicity is important. It has its value. We emphasize that a lot when we are so encouraged by the truth of the good news about Yeshua. But on the other hand, there are times when the meaning of something, what it means collectively in a large community, can trump even a detail of historicity. In this case, December 25th is when in the Western world this magnificent experience, this moment of Jewish history, so unique, so fabulous, the incarnation, the enfleshment of the Messiah, the eternal Word, the eternal Mashiach, that we were going to talk about it last week, but didn't get to do so because of that ice storm. So, I'm doing it today. Even though it's after the fact, it's okay, all right? Historicity important, but cut me a break today, okay? So I want to speak to you from this Parsha, and I'd like to begin just by asking you the basic question which underlines everything I want to say, and the question is this, and hopefully you can answer it even better for yourselves by the time we finish up. And the question is this: what do you see? What do you see? Now, let me give you an example from recent things. Have you seen the movie Wonder Woman? It's a good flick. I liked it a lot. Now, the question is, what do you see? Well, is it a movie about a very pretty actress, Gal Gadot, Israeli? Is it just about the fact that you need a woman superhero because of the empowerment, the desire to empower women, make them feel that not all superheroes are men? I think that's part of the message of the movie. But what else do we see? Well, we see a story with a backdrop in Greek mythology. And so you have Zeus mentioned, and you have, her name is Diana in the movie. So we can see a kind of reworking of the mythological stories of the Greeks and kind of put into this contemporary form, and it's all set against, of course, what the terrible things that happened during World War I. But I want to suggest to you, and let me give credit where credit is due, our very own President Emeritus Diane Cohen wrote about this several weeks ago. I couldn't find what you wrote, so I had to ad lib a little bit, but I remember a lot of it, so I'm not quoting from you, Diane. But what do you see? I think we see something much deeper in this movie, all right? So here she is, this Diana. She grows up in a place far away from Earth and yet really kind of in another dimension. And she's protected and she is honored. Her parents, one is Zeus, but she's not just from among the gods. She also has an Amazon mom. What else could we learn about her? She chooses to come into the world of trouble, in this case war, and all that the pain that war brings. One of the most striking things is that at the end of the movie, and I won't say too much to ruin it for you if you haven't seen it, but there is a figure named Ares, A-R-E-S, is that A-R-E-S, yes. And he is like Hasatan. He's like the devil. And he's trying to tempt her into destroying humanity because humanity doesn't deserve to be rescued. And so he is saying, team up with me and let us rule. Does that sound like someone we know? And believe me, it's intentional. And then, of course, there is a scene of her falling to the earth in cruciform fashion, arms outstretched, and it's a clear allusion to Yeshua. So the question is, what do you see in the story? Is it just about, you know, a pretty girl who takes her place among the superheroes? Is it about Greek mythology? I want to suggest to you it goes much deeper than that. And the movie's entertaining, and she represents a very strong moral character, which I think is another connecting point with Yeshua. So with all that, that's just by way of introduction and by way of sensitizing you to the question, what do you see in the narrative? What do you see? Now, I want to take you through the essence of last week's Parsha. And let's see what we see. So what's the story here? Well, you know, we've been in the story of Joseph. He is sold by his brothers into slavery. He's raised to the pinnacle of power in Egypt. And providentially, God has used him to bless a lot of people. But his brothers, who bear the collective guilt of having sent him into slavery when he was a 17-year-old kid, they encounter him and they don't recognize him. He doesn't look like a Jew anymore. He looks like an Egyptian. But he recognizes them, and he initiates a process of helping them make teshuvah so that trust can be regenerated and there can be reconciliation. The point comes in this story, if you read, you know that Joseph sets it up by putting a gold goblet in the backpack on the animal, the camel, of his youngest brother Benjamin. And it's a setup because he sends his soldiers to take them, to encounter them, and bring them back to Pharaoh as if they stole the cup. And again, in whose bag is the cup? It's in Benjamin. Who's Benjamin? The youngest son, the brother he never knew, the baby of the family, who in actuality may have not been so young, if you do the math. But that's not the point. Psychologically, in terms of the dynamics of the family, he's still the baby, even though he's in his 20s, perhaps 30s. So here we have this amazing moment when Judah, the eldest son, Vayagash, he presents him, he approaches Joseph. Sir, can I talk with you? And he describes what had happened. And he talks primarily in terms of his father. In fact, in his speech, the term Av, or father, is used 14 times. So the idea of the father looms very large in this whole section. He says, look, take me, I will be your slave. Just let Benjamin go home, because it's going to kill our dad if he doesn't come home again. He's the child of his old age. One of his sons was killed a long time ago. And at that point, Joseph just can't control himself anymore. He had been able to fake it up to this point, to pretend that he didn't know, he wasn't who he really was. Then, verse 1, Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. And so there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And I should say the commentators talk about how Joseph makes himself very vulnerable at this point. They could have killed him, maybe tried to escape. But he has everyone leave him. He was alone. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him. And Pharaoh's house heard about it. And they're all talking, what's wrong with the master? What is going on here? We've never seen him like this. He's usually so controlled. He's screaming and crying. And you can imagine all the talk among the chefs, among the maids, among the officials, among the soldiers in the household. And Joseph says to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? What's on his mind? His dad. That's what he asks. But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And you can understand that. Talk about a sense of disorientation. Talk about a moment when your life is being turned upside down. They didn't know what to think. And in the Midrash, it says that, you know, they were silent in Joseph's presence. It says, we will be silent when we stand in the presence of Hashem, when he accounts for how we've lived our lives. It's an interesting, very interesting comment. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. And when they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now don't be distressed and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. What do you see? You see a story of family reconciliation, of the beginnings of trust being rebuilt after years and years of mistrust. You see it at that level, but you see God working, providentially orchestrating things, Joseph says. Don't be mad at yourself. You did this, yes, but there was a larger purpose in what you did. Don't be angry at yourself, because God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh. Again, the theme of father comes up, and here he doesn't mean literally father. Oftentimes, father is used in a looser sense of an authority, if you will. But again, what's he point out? That there was a deeper meaning to the story. Just as we could look at this new movie and see deeper meanings in it. God is at work here. And he's made me father to Pharaoh and lord of his entire household and ruler in Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord over all Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and near me, you and your children and grandchildren and flocks and herds and all you have, and I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it's really I who speak to you. And again, I was thinking about this. What do you see? And you know, when he says, "Be'enechem ro'ot," and behold, your eyes see. And in the eyes of my brother, again, seeing my eye, the eyes of my brother Benjamin, this word that I'm speaking to you is true. Tell my father about the honor accorded to me in Egypt and about everything you have seen, and bring my father down here quickly. Tell dad I'm okay and I made out great. Still wants his dad to be proud of him, you know? Just part of the human experience. It transcends culture. It's just the way it always is. And he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him weeping. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and afterwards his brothers talked with him. Can you imagine that conversation? Would that have been great? The release has come. Forgiveness has been offered. The brothers have proven a certain trustworthiness. Trust is beginning to be developed again. It was enough for Joseph. And he could let it go. And he could see that there was a bigger picture in view, that God was up to something really, really great. His goal is much bigger than just teaching his brothers a lesson, as one commentator, Alan Dershowitz, suggested. It's the very restoration of the family, and we would understand, from our point of view, that the whole future of the Jewish people is tied to the salvation, the rescuing of this family, because this is the family that we all spring from, if we're Jewish, and secondarily, but very meaningfully, if we're not Jewish, from a spiritual sense, it's still true. And so, we see even more. We see God's subtle power. And we also see, which I won't take time to explicate too much right now, that this Joseph is an amazing picture of Yeshua himself. He's misunderstood by his brothers. He suffers at their hand. He rescues them. He's ultimately revealed to them and rescues them. I mean, there's a number of very interesting points in that connection. But I want to talk now, because again, this message was just prior to Christmas Day, which some Messianic Jews call Yom Yeshua, the day of Yeshua. People put it Messiahmas. The terms are unimportant, and we're happy to call it Christmas today. Now, I want to talk about the incarnation of Yeshua, and I want to ask what you see when it comes to understanding this magnificent person. Because he was born in a very odd way. He was born very normally in the sense that his mom, Miriam, was a Jewish young woman from a small town in Israel. And she's privileged in this amazing way to bear the Messiah. Here, looking back at the movie, and I'll offer an insight from C.S. Lewis, where he says that Greek mythology, which we can see operating in the movie I talked about earlier, that Greek mythology itself is wrong in many of its, you know, silly constructions of things and gods, angry gods and petulant gods and people and all their interactions. But there is something revelatory, even in Greek mythology, about gods and kind of connecting with humanity. It's a vague echo, but God did it providentially as an intimation of something that would actually happen in Jewish history. And we're talking about the incarnation. So what do we see? Well, we see it as a great moment, as I said earlier, in the flow of Jewish history. We, in our synagogue and in the larger Messianic Jewish movement, have not developed a liturgical expression, a way to celebrate and concretize these realities with the level of Jewish connectivity that they deserve. And we'll get there. We'll work on it. But it is one great moment. And we don't care about the specific historicity of the date. We care about the historicity of the event. That's another story. Now, for this, I would like to just spend a last few minutes with you looking not at the birth narratives, but I would like to look for a few minutes on Rav Shaul's comments about the nature of Yeshua and how they interface with this magnificent time of year that we celebrate the birth of the Messiah. And so this comes from Chaye Yeshua, the reading cycle that's used in our circles, developed by Rabbi Mark Kinzer and Rabbi Jonathan Kaplan. And it's the cycle that we use here at Ruach. And so last week's reading is from a letter that Shaul wrote to people living in Asia Minor. It's called Colossians, the city Colossae. And he says this about Messiah Yeshua. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. That concept of firstborn, the Greek is primogenous. It has to do with the unique Son, the unique one over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven, on earth, visible, invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He's above it all. And everything was made through him and for him. When as we say in the Aleinu, that he receives the appellation Adonai as he takes his place as the Lord over all creation in the future. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And the implication, I doubt it was in Paul's mind, but we who live in the world of, you know, science and quantum mechanics and all that kind of stuff, we could just say that whatever the laws are that govern how the universe works, all of them were created in and for and through the Messiah at the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. He's before all things, and all things hold together, and he is the head of the body, the ecclesia, the community, his community, made up of people from all the nations who love him and think he's the greatest, including our people Israel. This two-part ecclesia, part for the nations, part for Israel, slightly different and maybe even substantially different than our in our way of worship, etc., but nonetheless united at a profound level. He is the head of the ecclesia, the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. Firstborn among from the dead is an allusion to the resurrection, and then to the passage about dry bones, where one day all Israel will experience this resurrection, and all those who are in the Messiah. For God was pleased to have all his fullness, all God's fullness, dwell in him and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the execution stake. Now, we could spend hours with this, and maybe one day we will, but the question I leave you with is, what do you see? What do you see? Because that question impacts so much of what we're all about. The question, what do you see? We live in a very complicated world, and I have noticed, and maybe you have too, that there is kind of a collective angst which seems to pervade society generally. Have you noticed that before? It's not that everyone's unhappy all the time. It doesn't mean that no one is smiling or laughing, but there is a collective, generalized feeling of anxiety because the future seems so unclear. What kind of president do we have? What kind of Congress do we have? What's the source of true news and false news? All these often unarticulated questions are kind of swimming around in our minds. What about the economy? Will it be great? Will it be horrible? All these different things. How it will be for kids, your children as they grow up, and grandchildren, when opiate addiction is skyrocketing, and, you know, pornography among teenagers is like rampant. You know, all the different things. I'm not trying to bring you down, but I'm just trying to say that we have these questions. But here is the good news, if you have eyes to see it. We don't allow, and this is the choice we need to make, there is a choice, the machinations of powerful political, military, economic forces, we don't allow them to rob us of our joy, do we? We do not allow the questions to dominate our thinking, but rather we live, because of this great Messiah and the God of Israel who sent him, we live in joy. Sometimes the joy is quiet. Sometimes it's exuberant. But we have a feeling in the inner man and the inner woman. It's going to be okay. It is okay. As a matter of fact, to have the all-powerful God of the universe demonstrate his love to us by sending this little baby into our space who was ultimately the Messiah of Israel and Savior for the whole world. Wow. And so we choose to allow these realities to dominate our thinking, and we think about the greater Joseph, Yeshua, the one who one day, in a very obvious way, will get rid of all the bad, fulfill the words of the Aleinu, and be exalted as the one who redeems the world and makes it terrific. In the meantime, in your little sphere and my little sphere, we can experience little pieces of Olam Haba. Little pieces. If we choose to see and therefore to act rightly. And so I leave you with the question, what do you see? Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.